No species on Earth has such a huge parental task as the human animal. But when do we first become aware of the intensity of our parental feelings? We love our children, of course, but sometimes it takes a traumatic incident to bring home to us just how much we love them. It's little wonder, really, that we should feel so strongly, because biologically, they represent our immortality. Few moments in life crystallize with such clarity the strength of the emotional attachment that exists between parent and offspring as when a child goes missing at a big event. Somewhere among a vast crowd of 30,000 people at a country fair, desperate parents have become separated from their children. Horrors flash through their minds, injury, kidnap, or worse. Nothing seems too outlandish. The body language of distress is everywhere. A mother nervously clasps her face, an unconscious act of self-comfort. If there's nobody else to caress us or embrace us, we do it to ourselves. Yes.
Oh, we haven't gone to Hannah. Not yet.
The relief of reunion is overwhelming. As with many animal species, human parents would willingly risk their lives for their children. And these parents have just experienced a protective passion within themselves so powerful that it's left them deeply shocked. Now, only tight embraces and loving caresses can help them back to a more relaxed, quietly loving condition. The first day at school is almost as bad. Here, the separation is not accidental, society demands it. And both parent and child have been anticipating it. For both of them, it feels wrong, unnatural, and yet they know it has to happen. For some, the ordeal is almost more than they can bear. Our animal relatives would find the threat of such a separation a terrifying prospect. Any young ape or monkey would panic at the prospect of being distanced from its parental protection in this way. And the young human feels much the same. It takes a patient, loving parent to provide convincing reassurance that all will be well. The boy's movements are reminiscent of a caged animal, anxious to escape. At last, the father guides the child over the threshold and into the new phase of its life cycle. And this is what they're missing. All the tender moments they enjoy spending together, when embraces and hugs take them back to the earliest days of their relationship. The joyful times of close physical contact, when, through the body language of soft, smiling facial expression, casual, relaxed gesture, and gentle contact, the parent signals to the child, "I am here to protect you," and the child signals back, "I feel safe." At the end of every school day, when parents come to collect their children, one's reminded once again of the strength of the parental bond. But why do we devote so much time and energy to raising our young? Our species has the heaviest parental burden of any animal on Earth. Why are we so selfless when dealing with our children? To find the answer, we must begin at the beginning, at birth itself. Other animals give birth very easily. We do not. If we look at the old-fashioned way of delivering a baby, several facts stand out. The posture of the mother, her anxiety, and the clinical strangeness of the room, accentuated by bright lighting that only serves to destroy the intimacy of the moment. The newborn baby lies screaming on a table, out of touch with its mother's body, wildly grasping the air as if trying to make contact with her. For months inside her womb, it's been wrapped snugly by her body. Now, all that physical intimacy has been lost. The natural reaction at this point would be to put the baby into the embrace of its mother's arms. But here in Russia, in St. Petersburg, it is instead offered the embrace of swaddling clothes, bound and encased until it looks like a little Russian doll. This close binding does, of course, stop it crying, because it's reminiscent of the tight enfolding of the walls of the womb. But it also isolates the baby from any intimacy with its mother. Swaddling of this kind has been practiced for thousands of years and has always succeeded in quietening the infant because of the firm sense of bodily security it gives. The mother herself is also isolated, not only from her baby, but also from her family. They, for reasons of strict hygiene, are not permitted to enter the maternity hospital for 7 days. The mother must endure the drama of the birth without their familiar faces to reassure her. From now on, the mothers may only see their babies briefly for breastfeeding, when they're wheeled around the hospital on a trolley like so many tiny human Skittles. Eventually, when the mother is ready to go home, her baby is gift-wrapped for the brief presentation ceremony. After the clinical atmosphere of the hospital, the sentimental use of pink for a girl, or in this case, blue for a boy, seems strangely incongruous. When the father sees his child for the first time, he must then start to make his bond with the child. Neither he nor his wife have been given the chance to develop a true intimacy with their offspring. This old-fashioned approach to giving birth is far more widespread, even today, than most people imagine. In sharp contrast, a return to a much more natural process is now favoured. Birth in familiar surroundings, in the company of loved ones, is found to be far more relaxing. This mood of relaxation prevents her brain from flooding her body with special chemicals that would slow up the birth. Watched by her daughter and helped by her husband and a midwife, she gives birth with comparative ease.
Bend a little bit, bend a little bit. Bend a wee bit, Shelley, bend a wee bit. That's it.
When the moment of delivery arrives, the natural position for the human female is not lying on her back, working against gravity, but standing or squatting, to use gravity to help the baby emerge. This is the posture employed by tribal societies all over the world, and again, it makes the birth much easier.
Sit down, sit down. What's that? Up on your tongue. That's it.
Once the baby's been born, it's not immediately whisked away, but kept in direct contact with the mother's body, again ensuring a mood that is as calm and relaxed as possible. Delivered naturally in this way, the baby doesn't start screaming in panic, but lies quietly against its mother's flesh.
Blanket over her, or
The emotional bond between mother and infant is already beginning to form, and the baby, completely at ease, is already beginning to practice a few gentle kicking and stretching movements. For some mothers, this type of home birth is the ideal solution, but others may feel more relaxed in a hospital context, with all its advanced medical equipment on standby. Whichever scenario makes them feel most at ease will be the best. Newborn babies love to explore the exciting world in which they now find themselves. Providing the protective figure of the mother is close at hand, they'll happily swim in warm water. Sticking out their tongues to prevent swallowing and beating bravely with their stubby arms and legs while they stare intently at the strange sights they see before them. When this swimming ability was discovered back in the 1930s, it was explained away as nothing more than an automatic return to the womb. But it's more than that. The swimming baby actively suppresses its breathing. This didn't happen in the womb because the baby had not then started to use its lungs. Also, the swimming baby shows better coordination of movement in the water than it does on dry land at this age. And as this baby of only 10 days shows, the human infant can swim before it can crawl. This automatic swimming ability lasts for several months after birth. It then begins to decline to be replaced later by learned swimming. Swimming isn't the only surprising ability of the newborn human. Thanks to the research of a psychologist on the island of Crete, we now know that the human baby is capable of imitation just 15 minutes after being born. When he makes a particular gesture or facial expression, the baby watches closely and then copies him. He makes a movement with his hand. The baby's hand performs the same action. Now he tries a completely different kind of action, slowly sticking out his tongue. The baby fixates him with its eyes, registers what he's doing, and after a pause for its newly active brain to take it all in, then does the same. Until this was filmed, many experts refused to believe that such responsiveness was possible in the newborn, but it's here for all to see. Every baby stays wide awake during this first hour after birth, before dropping off into a deep slumber. And it's during this time that it normally makes visual contact with its mother, a crucial moment in the formation of the parent-offspring bond. For most people, it's the arrival of the firstborn that marks the moment when they begin to question the whole business of human parental care and the human life cycle. For me, it arrived a bit earlier when I found myself acting as the foster mother for a young chimpanzee like this one. In no time at all, the little chimp was reacting to me exactly as I was its mother, and I found myself experiencing very strong parental feelings towards the animal itself. I became fascinated by the similarities between the baby chimp and human baby, and also by the differences. The key difference was that the little chimp was able to cling on to my coat very firmly, much more so than a human baby. In the wild, chimpanzee mothers can walk or run or climb without worrying too much about the safety of their clinging offspring. But human parents have to employ all kinds of carrying devices to make sure that their babies can be safely transported as they go about their business. This baby is being rocked to and fro, another human speciality, performed in the same way all over the world. If a baby feels ill at ease, it sounds the human alarm call. It starts to cry. The parent responds by rocking the baby back and forth, an intuitive reaction performed at roughly heartbeat speed in every culture. The human baby, if it's not held against the mother's body as she walks along, finds that the comforting movements it knew inside the womb are missing. And it's this that sets off the crying, which then needs the rocking to calm it. The heartbeat speed of this rocking action suggests that the rhythmic sounds heard by the fetus inside the womb have a lasting effect. In hospitals, there are sometimes too many babies being looked after for each one to be cuddled and rocked individually. The solution is to place a crying baby in a mechanically operated cot that rocks with precisely the right motions, ingeniously recreated here with swaying movements that mimic the locomotion of a pregnant woman. This soon calms the infant and lulls it off to sleep. As with ordinary rocking, the mechanical rocking rhythm that's most effective is one that copies heartbeat speed, roughly 72 beats per minute, which spells peace and security. For both mother and baby, breastfeeding is more than just a milk supply. It's also a time of great intimacy. There's close eye contact during these moments, and the baby's vision is fine-tuned to focusing at this distance from its mother's face. It's an amazing fact that after only 45 hours of close contact following birth, the infant is capable of identifying its mother solely by her personal scent, and the mother also unconsciously learns the individual scent of her own baby.
Does that feel good? Is that good?
In the old-fashioned hospital, where strict routine demands that babies are fed only at set times and with the minimum of body contact, the mothers have to postpone the moments of intimacy until they're allowed to take their babies home. Fortunately, babies and mothers are resilient, and the loving bond will probably survive this severe discipline reasonably well. But nobody knows just how much emotional damage is done by these unnatural restraints. One of the great advantages of personal freedom where breastfeeding is concerned is the possibility of feeding on demand rather than by a strict schedule. The female breast and the baby's stomach are both designed for unrestricted demand feeding, and both suffer if a rigid time schedule is imposed. As time goes on, if nature's allowed to take its course, the milk supply will be regulated by the baby.
Shall I try and get you off the breast? Oh, dear! God, where did that come from?
During these early intimate moments, there's obviously much more going on between mother and baby than mere feeding. The sensitivity of the female nipples ensures that a deep sensual pleasure is derived from this activity, aiding the attachment process and creating a bond that sets the seal on years of intense loving.
Yes. Yummy, yummy. Look at that, go to sleep. Little thing. My little tamarind.
Before there was baby food, human babies were weaned by mouth feeding. This is rare today, but among the Maori of New Zealand, the baby is still given solids that have been masticated by its grandmother and then passed with a feeding kiss into its own mouth. And this, incidentally, reveals to us the origin of adult kissing. What is it that makes the human infant so appealing? Careful tests have shown that we adults have an automatic inborn response to the basic pattern of the baby face, and that we can't help feeling protective whenever we see big eyes, a large forehead, a button nose, and rounded cheeks. If we watch the young face growing up, we can see how these baby features are gradually lost as the time for personal independence comes closer. In the world of cartoons, animators too have exploited the appeal of the baby face. Here at Warner Brothers Animation Studios in Los Angeles, this famous character illustrates the point extremely well. His head is a combination of rabbit features and baby face features. The rabbit features are the long ears, the whiskers, and the buck teeth. The baby face features are the domed head, large eyes with big pupils, the soft jawline, the chubby cheeks, the tiny nose, and above all, the flattened face. It's this magic combination that gives Bugs Bunny his special appeal. So powerful are these baby face signals that we respond to them even in our pet animals. These dogs have been selectively bred over the centuries to make them more and more baby-like. Their faces have been flattened, their eyes enlarged, their bodies made more rounded, and their coats softer to the touch. The result is a perfect child substitute whenever, for whatever reason, a human infant is absent. These pets weigh the same as babies and are held like babies. The interactions with these dogs contain many of the elements of ordinary maternal care, and the intensity of the loving involved is similar. And when these owners talk to their dogs, even the high-pitched voice is the same. Observations of babies have revealed that in one particular way, they're strongly sexist. From birth, they prefer a high-pitched female voice to a deeper male voice. And it's intriguing that many fathers intuitively fight against this by adopting an unnaturally higher pitch when talking to their babies.
Yeah, what do you say? What do you say? What do you say?
Ooh. Ooh. Yeah, that's good, isn't it? Isn't that good?
There's a strong parental compulsion to chatter to babies. This is the babbling stage when babies all over the world are experimenting with the same kind of sounds. The development of speech from these early sounds has been captured here in a video sequence that shows in one child the two-year process reduced to a single minute.
Say please, Mummy.
Mummy.
How about toast?
No toast.
You don't like toast?
Bugs Bunny.
Yes.
And Donald Duck.
Yes.
I'm having milk and a baby horsey and a mummy horsey.
Ah.
Oh. Nice man putting in. What's it all about? Hmm? Sing a song, I said, but I'm
brilliant.
And the baby was laughing. And the baby was laughing.
He was, wasn't he?
One, a two, a three, a four, a six, a seven.
This unfolding of speech is an inborn character of our species, common to every one of us, regardless of the particular tongue that we learn to speak. Learning a language is only one of the social skills we must master. With our parents, when we're very young, we're often allowed, through their love for us, to have our own way. When we first encounter other children of our own age, the situation suddenly changes. Everyone wants his or her own way. And if there's a special toy that can't be shared, mayhem can ensue. Competition is more ancient than cooperation in the evolution of our species, and this soon becomes evident in the toddler's playground. For the loser, there remains the comfort of a momentary return to the security of early infant behaviour. As a way of introducing order into playground chaos, adults impose rules like picking your team for organized games. Being favored as a teammate is a signal of social status and group acceptance. If there's an odd number, someone gets left out. Although this may seem trivial to us, to the boy concerned, it's a moment of acute rejection and is hard to bear. Human beings are social animals, for whom one of the worst punishments is isolation, another of the hard lessons to be learned during childhood. Left to their own devices, the growing children soon start to experiment with their bodies, finding out what is possible with balance and rhythm. In its own good time, the human urge for cooperation starts to enter the scene. The children themselves amicably organize their games, as here in rural China, where these children play the traditional game of elastics. Genuinely helpful acts occur, of a kind that are rarely observed in the young of other species, but are remarkably common at this stage of human development. Soon, a new process appears, systematic learning. In our species, sexual maturity is delayed for a full decade while we program our complex brains with an astonishing mass of information, using a remarkable variety of techniques. Our passage through childhood is punctuated by special events. The ritual of blowing out the candles on a birthday cake proves our vitality and shows our complete control over the flames, representing the forces of nature.
When young birds become adult, they lose their juvenile plumage and adopt adult colours. When young humans become adult, the boys grow broader shoulders, the girls wider hips. But in addition to these biological changes, different cultures all over the world have added their own echoes of these changes, special rites of passage in which ceremonies take place to demonstrate a shift from one level to another. And very often there are symbolic steps which the young people go up, rising to a higher level in their life cycle.
One of the essential features of this type of ceremony is that the children must perform on their own. There's no parental hand to guide them. Society is making a takeover bid for them, weaning them slightly away from the family and more into the body of the tribe. They're becoming individual members of society who must now stand up for themselves. Now it's society and not the parent that feeds the young. Although, because they're socialising the young, most rites of passage are communal affairs, like this one, some are more private and personal. In rural Italy, this boy is coming of age. His grandparents must split a sapling in two and pass him through it, as though he's being born a second time. To emphasize this symbolism, he must strip naked like a newborn. Once he's been passed through the birth passage of the split tree, it's carefully bound up again so that it will continue to grow. Now, tree and boy will mature together. The strangeness of the act will leave its mark on the boy's memory and impress upon him that he's now reached a new phase in his life cycle. His body will grow like the trunk of the tree into strength and maturity. These rituals, these rites of passage, take many forms. Each society has its own rules and its own procedures. Precisely what they are is not especially important. But they must be there to add a sense of shared status.
To do my duty. To God and to the Queen.
These are essentially acts of tribal induction, when public uniformity momentarily takes over from privately developing individuality. Special salutes, emblems, badges and regalia all help to mark the occasion as one of social significance. And the symbolism of the occasion is marked by a symbolic leap away from childhood and towards adulthood. On a more personal scale, there are minor rites of passage that go almost unnoticed. With the arrival of puberty, the body undergoes changes that inevitably and automatically alter the social status of those approaching adulthood. The boy's first shave, or buying the girl's first bra, may seem trivial events to the outside world, but not to those involved. For them, this is a moment of biological maturing that's more profound than any of the more artificial rituals imposed by society.
Mum, yeah. I like this one.
Yeah, that's nice.
Eager
yeah,
to like move on to the next phase in the life cycle, these events are often premature. The boy's chin doesn't need shaving, and the girl's breasts hardly need support. But these facts are ignored in the rush towards active sexuality. Each society is fully aware that the next generation will want to change things, if only because of the creative energy of our species. The older generation welcomes a little change, but not too much, not enough to destroy the old order that they have worked hard to establish and maintain. Over and over again, they impose ceremonial conformity on the young. With the use of music and dramatically staged ritual, they attempt to endow the old order with an aesthetic appeal that reinforces its authority. Some of these young adults will rebel, but many more will be sufficiently impressed by these occasions to want to continue the status quo. The success of any society depends to a large extent on the balance it manages to achieve between innovation and tradition in each new generation. The problem with cultural indoctrination is that it can exploit the inherent tribalism of the young and direct them towards activities that may sometimes be more destructive than creative. The willingness of the young to follow group discipline can lead almost anywhere. The susceptibility to group attachment inherent in the maturing young can be turned into loyalty that's constructively inventive or, with almost equal ease, into loyalty that's potentially violent.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Take your seats. Good afternoon.
These particular children have been trained as expert killers. There's a vacant blankness on their faces, a complete absence of any sense of joyful childhood. And this 13-year-old boy has already gunned down his first adult enemy, an achievement for which he's congratulated incongruously with a motherly hug. Wherever there's the possibility of the need for military support, the usual familiar devices, bands and marching and smart uniforms, are employed to add glamour to the enrolment of the young in the status games of the old. The synchrony of the marching helps to synchronize the moods and minds of these young adults, and the rhythmic beating of the drums impinges directly on their physiology, as if it's an echo of their excited heartbeats. Everyone enjoys a parade, and almost unnoticed, the enjoyment tightens the social bonds and reinforces the local cultural traditions. Despite all the attempts of tribal elders to mould the young in their own image, the creative spirit fights back. Time and again, the young rebel, sometimes despairingly, sometimes joyfully. The childlike nature of our species can only take just so much conformity and uniformity before it demands a new toy, a new direction, even if eventually, after an exciting period of innovation, the rebels themselves become as predictable as their forebears. As youth comes to an end and family life beckons, society stages one more ceremony of indoctrination, this time into adulthood itself. Okay. Womanhood demands a display of healthy skin, shining hair, and firm breasts, the universal signals of female health and fecundity. The young adults are carefully prepared for the event, with all the specialised trappings of their particular culture. These trappings vary in detail, but they all play the same role, that of emphasising that these individuals are now available for pairing off and for setting up their own family units. Yesterday's children are about to become tomorrow's adults. In the years that follow, the human animal is at the peak of its physical condition. Couples are now preoccupied with establishing a pair bond, a family territory, and producing offspring of their own. So vital is this stage that we're loath to see it pass. When we arrive in our 40s, we attempt for the first time to slow down the life cycle. We suddenly take an interest in partners who are much younger than we are. For some, this is a phase of harmless fantasy. For others, it can lead to a full-blown midlife crisis. This is essentially a phenomenon of advanced Western society, where the human life cycle has been increasingly extended, creating a gap between the young parental phase and the older grandparental phase. This gap has to be filled with activities that delude the middle-aged into thinking that they're younger than they really are, into denying the aging process. This 85-year-old has just completed a full marathon run of 26 miles and fills us with admiration because he gives the rest of us the hope that the aging process can be defeated. Everywhere, the elderly refuse to accept that their bodies are in a state of physical decline and continue with the activities of their youth. But although avoided in public, the subject of mortality now becomes a private preoccupation. It may sound like a harsh question, but why do human beings live for so very long? Why is it that we live on past our reproductive age? Biologically, it doesn't make much sense. But it does make sense in a very special way, because unlike other species, the human animal has such a huge parental burden that a child not only needs parents, but also grandparents. And the grandparental role has been important in our species for probably a million years. Biologically, human beings are unique in having what we might call a serial litter. The young arrive year after year, so that human parents can face the problem of caring for a whole batch of children of different ages, all at once. For this, they do need as much help as they can get. And this is where the grandparents can be of enormous assistance. They can teach the young the old traditions of their culture. They can even teach the subtleties of Italian gesticulation. They can sit quietly with their grandchildren, acting as family guardians, playing their part in the protection of the offspring that contained their genetic material. In this way, active grandparents, far from being useless, become an essential part of human reproductive success and much loved in the process. But I wonder whether there's an additional, deeper reason for this extraordinary devotion to our offspring. In my exploration of the human life cycle, I'm reminded of one peculiar quality of the human animal. Other animals live in the present, but we can contemplate the future. That means that we can also contemplate our death. And as we grow older, this becomes a rather frightening prospect. So we have to protect ourselves in some way against it. And the way we do this is to conceive of an afterlife. To make it as attractive as possible, we decorate our tombs. And there's an Etruscan tomb here which illustrates this perfectly.
All over the walls of this tomb, artists have depicted with great accuracy everyday objects. There's a coil of rope here, a knife, a pickaxe, a drinking vessel, a belt of some kind hung up on a realistically depicted nail. The reason that they've done this so carefully is in order to make this tomb feel like home. This is a replica of an Etruscan house, so that the bodies lying in here can enjoy an eternal life as pleasant as the one they knew before. It gave them an afterlife that they could understand.
We have no scientific evidence either for or against the existence of an afterlife. For those who gain comfort from the idea, it acts as a valuable de-stressing device. And all around the world, religious organizations are present to supply this comfort. In this role, religion plays an important function, but it can go too far. If it suggests that people must put up with a miserable existence in this life in order to enjoy the next one, then it's become a confidence trick. And if it goes further and says that rival religions are wicked, then it's strayed into the wasteful world of holy wars and sectarian violence. When this happens, many people seek other answers. In recent times, the human urge to defeat death has taken on a new dimension. Here, in a cryonics facility in Southern California, the containers behind me hold 10 bodies, each of them at a temperature of minus 196 degrees centigrade. They're suspended in liquid nitrogen, and there they will stay until perhaps one day they can be revived. Now, the people who've had themselves treated in this way hold the perhaps slender hope, but nevertheless a real hope, that one day they can come back. But these people are hoping to return not in another place, but at another time. For some people, the only way to treat the subject of death is with cheerful celebration. In Mexico, the annual Day of the Dead is looked upon as a joyful reunion with departed friends and loved ones. By giving them this lively fiesta, it's felt that they'll join in the fun, if only in spirit. It's believed that the souls of the dead can be led by a trail of petals into the houses to participate in the feasting. This gives the living the hope that they'll be able to enjoy similar happy occasions in their afterlife. But for me, as a zoologist, the only guaranteed form of afterlife is through our genes, through our children, our offspring, who carry our genetic material. That's the real immortality, through our immortal genes. To our genes, we individuals, and our children, and their children, are merely temporary containers, with each generation passing on the baton of life. As parents caring for our offspring, we do our best to ensure that there's no break in this amazing evolutionary journey. Thank you.